A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. A friend of his just got prescribed Strattera for fatigue, depression, and what he calls poor executive function. Daniel himself tried it a couple years back and had a rough ride. Anxiety through the roof. None of the motivational push he got from Vyvanse. And he wants to know why that drug works so differently for different people. How it stacks up against bupropion for the ADHD depression fatigue triad, and whether Strattera is even relevant anymore now that Qelbree and other newer non-stimulants are on the market. He's also curious about real-world prescribing numbers. What percentage of ADHD patients are actually on long-term non-stimulants versus stimulants? There's a lot to unpack here.
It's a great clinical question, because the friend's symptom cluster, fatigue, depression, executive dysfunction, that's exactly the presentation where non-stimulants get considered. But Daniel's experience of anxiety is also super common. The two reactions aren't contradictory. They're both predictable once you understand what atomoxetine is actually doing in the brain, and how individual biology changes the equation.
Let's start there. What is it actually doing?
Atomoxetine is a selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. It blocks the norepinephrine transporter, or NET, which is the protein that vacuums norepinephrine back out of the synapse after it's been released. Block that transporter, and norepinephrine hangs around longer, activating receptors downstream. The key word is selective. It has essentially no affinity for the dopamine transporter. That's the fundamental difference from stimulants like Vyvanse or Adderall, which block both NET and DAT, and in the case of amphetamines, actually reverse the transporter so they pump neurotransmitter out instead of pulling it in.
If it's only touching norepinephrine, why does anyone describe it as helping IDHD at all? The whole stimulant story is dopamine. Dopamine, dopamine.
That's the first misconception worth busting. Dopamine is crucial, but where it's crucial matters. In the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that handles working memory, impulse control, planning, the dopamine transporter is actually pretty sparse. Most dopamine clearance in the PFC is handled by the norepinephrine transporter. NET picks up dopamine there because the two molecules are structurally similar enough that the transporter doesn't distinguish well. Think of NET as a bouncer at a club who's supposed to only let norepinephrine out, but dopamine keeps sneaking past because it looks enough like norepinephrine to fool the bouncer. Block that bouncer, and both molecules accumulate.
You block NET in the prefrontal cortex. You're getting a dopamine boost too, just one that's geographically restricted.
Atomoxetine increases both norepinephrine and dopamine in the prefrontal cortex specifically, but it doesn't touch dopamine in the striatum or the nucleus accumbens. The striatum is where dopamine drives motor activation and reward-seeking behavior. The nucleus accumbens is the pleasure and motivation hub. Stimulants flood both of those regions with dopamine, which is why they produce euphoria, increased motivation, and abuse potential. Atomoxetine leaves those areas alone.
Which explains the clean but weak feeling Daniel described compared to Vyvanse. He wasn't imagining it. The motivational engine that Vyvanse lights up in the striatum and accumbens, atomoxetine doesn't go there.
And that's simultaneously its biggest strength and its biggest weakness as a medication. If you need help getting off the couch and starting tasks, that striatal dopamine hit from stimulants is powerful. It's the difference between thinking, I should do the dishes, and actually feeling a little ping of anticipation about doing them. But if you have a history of substance use disorder, or you get terrible rebound anxiety when stimulants wear off, or you have cardiovascular issues that make amphetamines risky, atomoxetine's geographic specificity is exactly what you want.
Why did Daniel get anxiety from it?
This gets into the time course and the downstream effects. Atomoxetine hits peak plasma concentration in about 1 to 2 hours. It's fast in the blood, but clinical effects take 4 to 8 weeks to really manifest. That's a huge contrast with stimulants, which you feel in 30 to 60 minutes. The reason for the delay is that atomoxetine's therapeutic effect isn't just about having more norepinephrine in the synapse. It's about what the brain does in response to that sustained increase.
What does the brain do?
Over weeks, the postsynaptic neurons adjust their receptor density and sensitivity. There are downstream changes in gene expression. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNEF, gets upregulated, which promotes neuroplasticity and synaptic remodeling. The noradrenergic system in the prefrontal cortex is being retuned. That takes time. It's analogous to what we see with SSRIs for depression. You're not just flooding serotonin and calling it a day, you're waiting for the brain to reorganize itself around the new chemical environment. But in the first few days, before those compensatory changes happen, you're just getting the acute effect. Elevated norepinephrine signaling everywhere, NET is blocked, including in the locus coeruleus and the amygdala, which are involved in arousal and threat detection.
You're chemically cranking up the body's alertness system without having rewired the circuits that know what to do with that alertness yet.
Norepinephrine drives the sympathetic nervous system. Heart rate goes up, blood pressure goes up, you're in a heightened state of physiological arousal. If your brain interprets that arousal through an anxious lens, you get anxiety or even panic. It's the same reason public speaking makes your heart pound and your palms sweat. That's norepinephrine doing its job. Now imagine that sensation with no context, no reason, just sitting at your desk. Daniel's experience of feeling amped up but not productively motivated. That's the acute noradrenergic surge without the dopamine-driven reward pathway engagement you get from a stimulant.
His friend isn't having that experience, or at least not to the point of stopping the drug.
This is where pharmacogenetics comes in, and it's one of the most clinically important things about atomoxetine that most people don't know. Atomoxetine is metabolized by an enzyme in the liver called CYP2D6. About 7 to 10% of Caucasians are what's called poor metabolizers for CYP2D6. They have genetic variants that produce a barely functional or non-functional enzyme. In those people, atomoxetine clearance drops dramatically. They end up with five-fold higher plasma concentrations at standard doses.
That's not a subtle difference.
It's enormous. A poor metabolizer taking the standard 40 mg starting dose might have the drug exposure of someone taking 200 mg. And the side effects, nausea, anxiety, insomnia, appetite suppression, are all dose dependent. So someone who's a poor metabolizer might get slammed with side effects at a dose that a normal metabolizer barely feels. It's like the difference between sipping a beer and doing a keg stand. Same substance, radically different experience.
Which means Daniel's reaction versus his friend's reaction might not be about their ADHD subtypes or their brain chemistry in some vague sense. It might literally be about how fast their livers clear the drug.
It might be exactly that. And the clinical implication is straightforward, but underutilized. If you're starting atomoxetine, asking about CYP2D6 testing, or simply starting at a very low dose, 10 or 20 milligrams, and titrating slowly over 4 to 6 weeks can dramatically reduce the side effect burden. The standard 40 milligram starting dose is too high for a significant chunk of the population. But here's the thing, most prescribing guidelines still default to that 40 milligram starting dose. It's a systemic blind spot.
The friend's symptom profile, fatigue, depression, executive dysfunction, that's also telling. That's the prefrontal cortex norepinephrine hypothesis in a nutshell. Low noradrenergic tone in the PFC produces exactly that constellation you can't initiate, you can't sustain effort, your working memory is foggy.
And atomoxetine, by boosting norepinephrine and indirectly dopamine in the PFC, directly targets that. The friend might be a normal or even rapid metabolizer who gets the therapeutic effect without the toxic plasma levels. Or he might be a poor metabolizer who just happens to tolerate the higher exposure better. Either way, it's a reminder that this drug gave me anxiety, and this drug saved my functioning can both be true, and the difference isn't just subjective, it's biological and measurable.
Let me push on that a bit. If the friend is a poor metabolizer getting fivefold plasma levels, wouldn't we expect him to feel something? Nausea? Jitteriness? Something? You're saying some poor metabolizers just cruise through it.
That's a fair question, and it gets at something important. Being a poor metabolizer doesn't guarantee side effects, it guarantees higher plasma concentrations. Whether those higher concentrations produce side effects depends on individual sensitivity at the receptor level, which is a whole other layer of genetic and epigenetic variation. You could have two poor metabolizers with identical blood levels, and one feels like their skin is crawling while the other feels fine. The CYP2D6 status sets the ceiling for drug exposure, but it doesn't dictate the subjective response. That's why pharmacogenetics is a tool for risk stratification, not a crystal ball.
That's the basic pharmacology and the individual variability piece. But Daniel's question was also comparative. How does atomoxetine stack up against bupropion, which gets prescribed for a lot of the same people, the ADHD depression fatigue triad?
Let's do that head-to-head because the choice between these two is something clinicians face all the time, and the reasoning isn't always explained to patients. Bupropion is a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor, an NDRI. It blocks both NET and DAT, meaning it increases norepinephrine and dopamine throughout the brain, not just in the prefrontal cortex. That includes the striatum and the nucleus accumbens.
Pharmacologically, bupropion sits somewhere between atomoxetine and the stimulants. It's touching dopamine more broadly than atomoxetine, but less aggressively than Adderall or Vyvanse.
That's exactly how it feels to many patients. It has a mild activating effect. Some people describe it as a low-voltage stimulant. It can improve energy, motivation, and focus, but without the pronounced euphoria or the sharp on-off of amphetamines. And because it hits dopamine and reward-related circuits, it has some mild abuse potential, though far less than stimulants. It's a Schedule III controlled substance in some countries, though interestingly not in the US, where it's not scheduled at all.
It's not FDI, approved for ADI, HD.
It's not. It's approved for major depressive disorder and for smoking cessation. Its use in ADHD is entirely off-label, and the evidence base is weaker than for atomoxetine. A 2023 meta-analysis of 14 randomized controlled trials found atomoxetine had a moderate effect size, standardized mean difference of about 0.64 for ADHD symptoms in adults. Stimulants are in the 0.9 to 1.2 range. Bupropion's effect size for ADHD is generally in the 0.3 to 0.5 range in the studies that exist, and those studies tend to be smaller and less rigorous.
If atomoxetine is already considered a moderate effect option compared to stimulants, bupropion is a notch below that.
For core ADHD symptoms, yes. But, and this is the clinical art, bupropion might be the better choice if depression is the dominant complaint. If someone's depression is so severe that it's driving the executive dysfunction and the fatigue, treating the depression with a drug that also has some IED-IHD benefit makes sense. It's one pill for two problems. Atomoxetine isn't approved for depression, and the evidence for it as an antidepressant is mixed at best. There was a decent-sized trial in 2005 that showed no significant separation from placebo for major depressive disorder. So, if depression is the primary engine of impairment, atomoxetine might leave you undertreated on that front.
The decision tree might be, if depression is the primary driver, lean bupropion. If ADHD is primary with some secondary mood symptoms, lean atomoxetine.
That's a reasonable heuristic. But there are other factors. Anxiety is a huge one. Bupropion, because of its dopaminergic and noradrenergic activation, can worsen anxiety. It's not uncommon for people with comorbid anxiety disorders to feel more jittery, more on edge on bupropion. I've had patients describe it as feeling like they drank 4 cups of coffee on an empty stomach. Productive, but unpleasant. Atomoxetine has a more mixed relationship with anxiety. Some people get worse, as Daniel did, but others actually see their anxiety improve as their executive function gets better and their life stops feeling like a constant crisis of drop balls and missed deadlines.
What about the seizure risk with bupropion? That's the thing everyone mentions, but nobody can quite quantify.
It's real, but dose-dependent. At the standard dose of 300 milligrams per day, the seizure risk is about 0.1%, 1 in 1,000. At 450 milligrams per day, it rises to about 0.4%. For context, the general population risk of a first seizure is about 0.08 to 0.1%. So bupropion at standard doses roughly matches the background risk. At higher doses, it's about 4 times higher. It's contraindicated in people with seizure disorders or eating disorders, and it's something to be cautious about in people with heavy alcohol use who might be at risk for withdrawal seizures. The mechanism is thought to be related to the drug's inhibition of nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, but honestly, the exact pathway isn't fully nailed down.
Atomoxetine doesn't carry a seizure risk.
Its risk profile is different. The main things to watch are heart rate and blood pressure increases. It typically adds 5 to 10 beats per minute and a few millimeters of mercury to blood pressure. Plus the gastrointestinal stuff, nausea, decreased appetite, sometimes constipation. And the anxiety piece we already discussed. There's also a rare but serious liver injury warning on the label, though the incidence is extremely low. We're talking maybe one in several hundred thousand patients.
If a patient has a history of substance use, atomoxetine is the clear winner. No abuse potential, not scheduled, no street value.
And that's a significant consideration because ADHD itself is a risk factor for substance use disorders, the impulsivity, the self-medication. Something like 30 to 40% of adults with untreated ADHD have a comorbid substance use disorder at some point. Giving those patients a drug with no dopaminergic action in the reward centers is a major advantage. You're treating the prefrontal cortex without lighting up the nucleus accumbens. It's pharmacologically elegant, even if it's less viscerally satisfying for the patient.
Now let's talk about the elephant in the room. Daniel mentioned a newer non-stimulant got FDI approval a few years ago. Is Stratera about to become obsolete?
Viloxazine, brand name Qelbree, was approved by the FDIE in April 2021 for ADHD in children and adolescents, and then extended to adults in 2022. It's also a norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, so it shares the core mechanism with atomoxetine. But it has some additional pharmacology that makes it interesting.
What else does it hit?
Viloxazine also antagonizes the serotonin 5-HT2C and 5-HT2B receptors. 5-HT2C antagonism is particularly relevant because that receptor normally inhibits dopamine and norepinephrine release in the prefrontal cortex. Block it, and you disinhibit those systems. You get more dopamine and norepinephrine in the PFC on top of what the net blockade is already doing. It's like taking the parking brake off while also pressing the accelerator. 5. HT2B antagonism is less clearly relevant to ADHD, but might contribute to the side effect profile. And it's worth noting that 5-HT2B agonism is the mechanism behind the cardiac valvulopathy issues with drugs like fenfluramine, so antagonizing that receptor is probably a neutral or even protective feature.
It's an NRI plus a disinhibitor of the same systems the NRI is trying to boost. A 1-2 punch.
That's the theory. Whether it translates to meaningfully better efficacy in the real world is less clear. We don't have large head-to-head trials of viloxazine versus atomoxetine. The indirect comparisons, looking at separate placebo-controlled trials, suggest similar effect sizes for ADHD symptoms. The differences show up more in tolerability.
What kind of differences?
Viloxazine seems to cause less nausea than atomoxetine, which is a big deal because nausea is one of the most common reasons people stop atomoxetine. It also tends to cause more somnolence, more sleepiness, especially in the first few weeks. That can actually be an advantage if the patient has insomnia, which is common in ADHD, but it's a problem if they're already struggling with fatigue. The viloxazine label carries a warning about suicidal thoughts and behaviors in pediatric patients, which atomoxetine doesn't have, though atomoxetine does have a warning about rare liver injury. Different safety flags, different tolerability trade-offs.
What about cost? Because that's often the thing that determines what people actually end up taking.
This is where atomoxetine still has a major advantage. It went generic years ago. You can get generic atomoxetine for $30 to $60 a month without insurance. Qelbree is still brand only. Supernus Pharmaceuticals holds the patent. And as of 2026, the cash price is around $300 to $500 a month. Manufacturer copay cards can bring that down for commercially insured patients. But if you're uninsured or on Medicare or Medicaid, that's a massive barrier. I've seen patients do great on Qelbree for 3 months on a copay card, then lose coverage and have to switch back to atomoxetine simply because $500 a month isn't sustainable.
Atomoxetine isn't going anywhere, at least not until Qelbree goes generic.
Even then, it might not. Atomoxetine has been on the market since 2002. It has the longest safety track record of any non-stimulant ADHD medication. We have 2 decades of data on what happens when people take it for years. Viloxazine has been on the U.S. market for about 5 years. That matters especially for pediatricians and for patients who are cautious about newer drugs. Plus, some people just respond better to one than the other. The mechanisms overlap but aren't identical. The serotonin receptor piece means viloxazine might work for someone who got nothing from atomoxetine, and vice versa.
What about the real-world numbers? Daniel wanted to know what percentage of IDHD patients are actually on non-stimulants, long-term versus stimulants.
The prescribing data is pretty consistent across IQVIA and CDC datasets from the last few years. About 70 to 75% of ADHD patients on medication are prescribed stimulants. That's methylphenidate-based drugs like Ritalin and Concerta, and amphetamine-based drugs like Adderall and Vyvanse. About 15 to 20% are on non-stimulants. That includes atomoxetine, viloxazine, guanfacine, and clonidine. And about 5 to 10% are on combination therapy, meaning a stimulant plus a non-stimulant together.
Stimulants still dominate, but non-stimulants are not a tiny niche. 15 to 20% is millions of people.
And within the non-stimulant segment, atomoxetine still holds about 60% of the market. Viloxazine has captured roughly 20% since its approval. The rest goes to the alpha-2 agonists, guanfacine and clonidine, which work through an entirely different mechanism. They're not reuptake inhibitors at all. They're centrally acting alpha-2 adrenergic receptor agonists that improve prefrontal cortical function by strengthening noradrenergic signaling at the postsynaptic receptor level.
Guanfacine is interesting because it's often used in combination with stimulants. It can take the edge off the stimulant side effects, the irritability, the rebound, the insomnia, while adding some additional executive function benefit.
And it's also first line for ADHD in kids with significant aggression or tic disorders. Different tool for a different presentation. But in terms of pure monotherapy for adult ADHD, atomoxetine and viloxazine are the main non-stimulant players. Guanfacine as monotherapy for adults has pretty modest effect sizes. It's usually an adjunct, not the star of the show.
Let's walk through some clinical scenarios to make this concrete. A 28-year-old comes in with ADHD depression, no anxiety. What's the move?
If the depression is moderate to severe, bupropion is a very reasonable first choice. It treats both conditions with one pill, the side effect profile is well characterized, and it's cheap. If the depression is mild and the ADHD is the clear driver of impairment, I'd probably start with a stimulant, actually, because the effect size is larger and the onset is immediate. If the patient can't take stimulants for whatever reason, substance history, cardiovascular issues, intolerable side effects, then atomoxetine or viloxazine, with the choice between them driven by cost, tolerability, and the patient's specific symptom profile.
Same patient, but now they have panic disorder.
That changes things. Bupropion becomes less attractive because of the anxiety risk. Stimulants can also exacerbate panic. Atomoxetine is a mixed bag for anxiety, as we discussed, but it's probably a safer bet than bupropion here. Viloxazine, with its serotonergic activity, might be worth considering. The 5-HT2C antagonism could theoretically have anxiolytic effects, though we don't have robust data on that. Guanfacine is also an option because it lowers sympathetic outflow and can actually reduce anxiety. Some clinicians even use guanfacine off-label for anxiety disorders independent of IDHD.
What about the patient who's tried atomoxetine, had Daniel's experience of anxiety and nausea, and is ready to give up on non-stimulants entirely?
That's the misconception we should address directly. Non-response to one non-stimulant doesn't predict non-response to another. The mechanisms are different enough. Atomoxetine is a pure NRI. Viloxazine is an NRI plus serotonin receptor antagonist. Bupropion is an NDRI. Guanfacine is an alpha-2 agonist. That failing one tells you almost nothing about the others. The trial and error process is frustrating, but it's normal and expected. Most people don't hit the right medication and dose on the first try.
The numbers bear that out. In clinical trials, the response rate for any single ADHD medication, stimulant or non-stimulant, is somewhere around 60 to 70%. That means 30 to 40% of people won't get an adequate response and will need to switch or augment.
And that's not a failure of the medication class. It's a reflection of how heterogeneous ADHD actually is. The attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, label probably covers multiple distinct neurobiological conditions that happen to share a surface-level symptom pattern. Different underlying pathologies respond to different pharmacological interventions. It's like calling everything that causes a cough disorder, and then being surprised that antibiotics don't help everyone.
Which brings us to the future. Is there anything on the horizon that might change this landscape?
There are a few things worth watching. The TAAR1 agonists trace amine-associated receptor 1 are in early-stage trials. TAAR1 is a receptor that modulates dopaminergic and noradrenergic signaling in a more nuanced way than direct transporter blockade. The idea is you could get the therapeutic benefits of stimulants without the abuse potential and the crash. Ulotarant and Ralmitarant are the two that have been in clinical trials for schizophrenia, but the same pathway is being explored for ADHD. The early data is mixed, but the concept is compelling.
There's also the pharmacogenetics piece. If CYP2D6 testing becomes routine, and it's getting cheaper, we could potentially predict who's going to have a rough time on atomoxetine before they ever take a pill.
That's the dream, and it's getting closer. Pharmacogenetic panels that include CYP2D6 are already available direct to consumer, though the clinical utility is debated. The bigger challenge is that CYP2D6 status only explains part of the variability in atomoxetine response. There are probably dozens of genes involved, transporters, receptors, downstream signaling molecules. We're not at the point where a cheek swab tells you which ADHD medication to take, but we're moving in that direction. The other thing worth watching is the repurposing of existing drugs. Solriamfetol, which is currently approved for narcolepsy and sleep apnea-related excessive daytime sleepiness, is a dopamine norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor with a different binding profile than bupropion. There's interest in whether it might have ADHD applications, particularly for the fatigue-heavy presentations.
The actionable takeaways here are pretty clear. If you're starting atomoxetine, ask about starting low, 10 or 20 milligrams, and going slow. The standard 40 milligrams starting dose is too high for a lot of people, especially if you happen to be a CYP2D6 poor metabolizer. Second, non-stimulants aren't weaker stimulants. They're different tools for different jobs, and for certain symptom profiles, fatigue, emotional dysregulation, comorbid anxiety, they might actually be the better tool. And third, if atomoxetine doesn't work, don't write off the whole category. Viloxazine, bupropion, guanfazine, they all work through different mechanisms, and the trial and error process is normal.
I'd add, if you're the friend in this scenario, the one who just got prescribed Stratera, give it time. The 4 to 8 week timeline is real. The first week of nausea and jitteriness is not what the drug feels like long term. The brain adapts and most of the side effects diminish. Whether the therapeutic effect emerges is the question, and you won't know the answer for at least a month. Also, eat something when you take it. A surprising number of people take it on an empty stomach and then wonder why they're nauseous. Food in the stomach cuts the GI side effects substantially.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The word mead, the fermented honey drink, traces back to the early 1500s through Middle English mead and Old English medu. But the oldest known written recipe for mead appears in the Timbuktu manuscripts of Niger, dating to the Songhai Empire, where it was called tonga and brewed with honey from the desert date palm.
Desert date palm honey mead from medieval Timbuktu.
I'd try it.
You'd try anything with leaf or honey in the description.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com. And if you've got a weird prompt of your own, send it our way.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.